So I'm going to just talk a little bit about chitta. Chitta is this word that means something like mind and heart. And this whole idea of the mind and the heart being separate is a very Western concept from Descartes, I believe. But in traditional Buddhism, the mind and the heart are never seen as separate. And if you think about it in experience, if I think about my experience, almost every thought that I have has an emotional component, and every emotion that I have has thinking associated with it. So they do seem to come as a package. But yeah, it's quite interesting the way we tend to separate these things out in the West. But the way I'm going to approach it today is just seeing it all as an arising in the moment of the mental-emotional continuum within the broad shape of the mind. So the verses of chitta is essentially asking us to observe, is greed present in our mind, or is the absence of greed present in our mind? Is aversion or irritation or even hatred present in our mind, or is the absence of aversion present in our mind? Is delusion present in our mind? That's quite tricky, because as soon as you know there's delusion, you're probably not deluded anymore. But if you kind of get aware of a vague, confused state, that would be delusion. Or is the absence of delusion present in our mind? Is our mind contracted, tight, tense? Or not contracted, tight and tense? Or is our mind distracted, all over the place, scatty? Or is our mind the opposite of that? And then there's some other verses which we're not going to particularly attend to this morning in a specific way when we do the meditation, but they're nice to know that we're also being encouraged to see, is our mind great or not great? Is our mind surpassable or unsurpassable? Meaning, is there further to go in this meditation, or do we feel we've kind of arrived at some...
Does great mean large or fat?
I think it means loving, actually. Okay. It's apparently in Pali, the word is something, the similar word to that used in the Brahmaviharas. I'm going to say a bit more about love later on. Is our mind concentrated or not? And is our mind liberated or not? But I think from practical terms, just really learning to identify are the poisons present or not, that's very useful, very, very useful practice. And so what we're looking at here is the karmic and ethical aspect of the mind. So chitta is what's called... karma, which means it's active, it's volitional, and it will lead to future consequences. Whereas Vedana, that we looked at yesterday, that's considered a resultant. So it's just arrived. Here it is. You've got a pain in your body. It's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. You can't do anything about that. But we can do something about the sort of stream of momentum of our emotional and mental continuum. It's quite nice in the Tibetan tradition, they refer to the mind as the mind stream, which I really enjoy. Mind stream. So we're coming to something a bit more active in the area of chitta. Because obviously greed, hatred and delusion, they're active states, aren't they? You know, they certainly feel active to me. They've got a momentum to them that will lead to some kind of consequence in the next moment, depending on how we respond to it. Obviously if we feed it, we're going to even be more angry. If we're aware of it and we use the awareness to take some of the momentum out of that, then we'll be less angry in the next moment. I mean, it's all so simple. Hard to do, but conceptually, this whole teaching is very, very simple. So the main point of chitta, the chitta dimension, or in any of the dimensions of the Satipatthana Sutta, is simply to get to know your experience. So in this case, we're getting to know our mind, moment by moment. It really is looking like in the mirror. What is actually going on in there right now? Which again sounds quite simple, but that is a radical act for a human being, because most of us, we're not aware directly of what's going on. We've got layers and layers and layers of interpretation, judgment, opinion, ideas of what should or shouldn't be happening, but we're peeling all those away to be honest. What's going on in there? You know, what's going on in there right now in this moment? So Anālayo describes it as becoming aware of the condition of your mind, which I think is very good, because in our lives we're encouraged to be aware of the condition of our body. Is it fit? Is it unfit? healthy, unhealthy? Can I tend to my diet? Can I tend to my exercise? You know, we're encouraged to learn to, you know, take responsibility for our physical well-being. Likewise, we can be encouraged to take responsibility for our mental well-being. And the Dharma gives us all kinds of tools and strategies in order to do that. But you can really only do that if you know what's happening. So that this extraordinary capacity to turn our awareness inwards and to know what we're thinking, that is a remarkable skill that we have as human beings. And the attitude that we bring to this practice is play. It's very nice the way play is becoming a theme throughout this retreat. It's playful. It's receptive, so it's a very receptive way of meditating. It's curious. You know, what is going on in there? What am I thinking? What is the condition of my mind? How fascinating to be really curious before all the judgments come in. This is what anger feels like. How interesting. We're open. And we're not harsh. This is very, very important because we're so conditioned to be harsh towards ourselves and our experience. So if you've got despair, I shouldn't be feeling this. Well, guess what? You are feeling it. So how can I learn to be with that in a creative, open, receptive way? Understanding that everything's changing all the time. Yeah. This is something that Papandajani touched on. Something I've really, a very significant growth point in my own practice, I would say, is when I allowed my mental states to change. Because what used to happen is I'd wake up in the morning and I might feel crap for either physically or just low or tired and anxious. And then I would immediately have a view that the whole day was going to be a write-off. Okay, I'm going to have a really rubbish day today. But when I learned to apply this this sort of insight, I suppose, that everything's changing all the time. Very often, half an hour later, I feel fantastic. Then half an hour later, I feel rubbish again. And it's just this kind of, you know, there's the wave motion of the human life. So it's very important to allow our experience to change with this open, receptive quality, because you never know what's going to show up. So then it can even be quite exciting. You know, I wonder what's going to come along next in my awareness. But of course, if we're harsh, we wake up in the morning, we feel down, and then we judge ourselves for feeling down, we're contracting around it, we're fixing it, and we're more likely to stay in that state. Whereas if it's like, this is what being down feels like, how interesting. Maybe then you can make choices, creative choices. Maybe I need to do some stretching, maybe I need to put some music on and dance around the room. Maybe I need a strong coffee. You know, you can make these choices about what to do in relation to that mental state, and then you're allowing it to become something anew, moment by moment. So Analia says, which I think is very good, it's good to treat the mind a little bit like a child or a pet. So children are quite unruly. They're very playful, but they can be unruly. And if you shout at your child or you shout at your pet, they're not going to really respond very well, are they? They might become sort of submissive, but it's a horrible sort of cowed, frightened submission. We don't want to have a mind that's frightened and submissive. We want a spirited, alive, alert mind that's treated with encouragement and treated with care. So I think that's really nice, actually, treat your mind like a pet or a child when it's misbehaving. You know, to sort of try to oppress it really doesn't work. Don't oppress your mind. And one of the central things of Satipatthana practice is the realization that awareness itself is often enough. So if you're in a state and you become aware of that state, let's talk about a negative state for a moment, you become aware of a negative contracted state, that is completely different from being lost in that state. It's a profoundly different experience because you step out of it just a little bit. So you're no longer completely consumed by anger. You're a person who is aware of angry thoughts, angry emotions. And so often that's enough. I mean, sometimes we can apply more specific antidotes, but it's nice to understand that awareness itself is transformative. If you've got your view established, as I talked about earlier in the week, if you're aware that your deepest longing in this life is to be free, or your deepest longing in this life is to be loving, or your deepest longing in this life is to see things clearly, then as soon as you bring awareness to your experience, you'll quite naturally move towards greater openness, because that's your overall values. I don't know anybody, if they've established their kind of compass, their view, and then they become aware of a contracted state of anger, that they then think, I know, I'll make myself more angry now. We just don't do that, do we? It's more like we're anger. Oh, this is what it feels like. Come back to the body, come back to the breath, soften, open, and it will change. So it's quite delicate, and yet it's immensely courageous. So it's having the delicacy of a bumblebee and the heart of a lion doing this kind of practice. So let's just talk a little bit about thoughts. I was thinking that the shape of the mind, is it broadly a craving mind, an aversive mind, a confused mind? The shape of the mind is the context, and all the thoughts that are crowding in the mind are the content of the mind. And it's important to understand that it's completely normal to think. The mind is a sense organ, like the other organs in Buddhism. So it's normal for an eye to see, it's normal for ears to listen, it's normal for a nose to smell, and it's normal for a mind to think. Because this can be quite confusing for people, where sort of thinking is bad and we should have this completely empty, still mind. Minds just generate thoughts, that's what they do. So that's important. But what we're doing with this kind of practice is we're learning to let go of identifying so strongly with the content of the mind and to step a little bit away from it while the thoughts are still there, often. So the sort of images of thoughts are like clouds passing across the sky of the mind. Thoughts are like leaves floating down a stream in the autumn. These kind of images are helpful, I think. So the thoughts are still there. But rather than identifying with the content, we're identifying with the container of awareness instead. So just a little bit about thoughts that you will hopefully find quite reassuring if your thoughts are not altogether wholesome. And probably most of us haven't got 100% wholesome thoughts. That the untrained mind is very tricky. Paul Gilbert's a psychologist who's done a lot of work around compassion-focused therapy, a very interesting guy. And he's looked a lot at evolution and so on. And when he gives talks, he always says, it's chaotic in there. It is normal for it to feel all a bit chaotic. And this is partly from evolution, because we're, I think I touched on this the other day, but we're vulnerable creatures. So we're generally hypervigilant to threat. So we've got much more of our nervous system devoted to staying alive than devoted to enjoying beauty, say. So that the imperative to stay alive, preservation of the species, that's the overarching imperative for us neurologically and in terms of our mind. So we tend to be very aware of threat, sort of threat-oriented creatures, which is the whole fight-flight-freeze response. So fight-flight-freeze kicks in very, very quickly for human beings. So how many thoughts do you reckon an untrained mind would have on a day?
Millions.
Millions? Okay. Any other bids?
10 to 15,000.
10 to 15,000, yeah. Any other bids?
Three or four.
Repeated.
Endlessly.
Okay, so it's 30 to 70,000. The research around this is a little bit sort of, yeah. Some people say it's just an internet meme and somebody made it up somewhere. Mm-hmm. But I think it's probably, seems quite reasonable.
I don't know how you could differentiate one thought from another, because they just flow into each other, don't they? Where does one stop and the other?
I know, that's where it's, I think the main point I'm trying to make is it seems that there are tens of thousands of thoughts a day. And I think that's probably quite reasonable. I think somebody else, the guy who did Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman, he said the present moment is about 3 seconds. So, we're having at least one thought every 3 seconds, most of us, and I can have multiple thoughts at once. Don't know about the rest of you. Okay, so let's. Are you happy to accept? Maybe we've got tens of thousands of thoughts a day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the untrained mind, what percentage do you think are negative?
More than 50%.
In the untrained mind, what percentage of these tens of thousands of thoughts a day are negative?
90%.
So we've got more than 50, we've got 90.
70%.
Yes, but it's about 75%. That's staggering, isn't it? That the normal, unaware human being is going about their life, they've got thousands of thoughts a day, and three quarters of those thoughts will have a negative flavour, which I think goes back to we're just hypervigilant around, you know, how can I keep myself safe? Okay, so how many of those thoughts do you think you've had before?
95%.
Yeah, more than 95%.
99.
Yeah, more than 95% are repetitive. Mm. And Nagasiddhi's case of 3 or 4 thoughts a day, probably all of them are repetitive. If you're only having 3 or 4 thoughts a day, then they're probably the same ones going round and round. Sorry, say that again.
Only one positive one.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, you've got one positive, yeah. You've got one positive repetitive thought to sleep. So I find that kind of reassuring, these stats, that, you know, when my mind's feeling like it's a chaotic jumble of repetitive, not very skillful thoughts, that's just normal. It's helpful to normalise what's going on. So I think on the spiritual path, we can think, oh, we should be all saintly. And if we're thinking at all, we're getting it wrong. And if we're not sort of just a continual stream of positive mental events, we're getting it wrong. Clearly, you know, the path is about growth, and we can learn how to cultivate more positive thoughts and how to let go of the more negative thoughts, without a doubt. You know, that's definitely been my experience over the years, that my mind stream is perfumed by much more brightness than it was. So I want to say that because I want you to be encouraged as well. And I can have, you know, really toxic thoughts. Of course I can. I've got a mind, I've got a nervous system, I've got stimulation coming at me, and I've got difficulties. So what we're going to be doing this morning is trying to sort of notice our thoughts with this playful, receptive, gentle mind. But what's it like to then let go of over-identifying with the content? Because actually, as we're discovering, most of our thoughts are just the same old rubbish going round and round. And yet we get so hooked into it. We disappear down the rabbit holes again and again and again. And that's not helpful. I mean, that's quite a thought, isn't it? We've got the same old rubbish going round and round, and yet we give it so much attention. Mm-hmm. We get so seduced by the contents of our minds. So what's it like to let go of that and just keep dropping back into breath, into body, into breath? This is what this tendency towards aversive emotions is like. I'm not going to get into all the thinking about it. I'm just going to notice that and come back to the midline. This is what craving is like. I'm not going to get into all the thoughts, I'm just going to drop back to the midline. So it's this fluid, open, receptive, kindly practice. And of course, we can harness imagination within that process. So I'm just going to touch on this actually, because I realise we haven't really talked about how do you sort of work with the imagination within a structured meditation practice. Say the mindfulness of breathing or the metta bhavana. You know, you could be forgiven for thinking that we're suggesting just get rid of all that and just let your imagination play. But what we can do is we can bring imagination into the structure of our practice. And then we can just notice when we're tipping into these different mental and emotional states. So I thought I'd be bold and share with you a little bit how I work with that this morning. Because sometimes it's quite helpful to hear it's the specifics of what do you actually do? What does one actually do? So this morning I woke up. It was one of those mornings actually where my mental events was, today's not going to be a very nice day. It was quite interesting. My back pain's been not at all good this week. And I've been having quite difficult nights. So I woke up feeling tired, thinking, oh God, you know, how many more days is it? And then I thought, okay, come on, you know, This is just what you're experiencing now. Take this into your meditation practice. And actually simply getting up and having a shower, I felt much better. So that was interesting, making that choice to do that as opposed to stay in bed, which was also an option. I thought, no, it would be good to move. So I came in here, I sat down, I was feeling, but this was interesting because I was allowing myself to feel what was authentic in that moment. I also felt quite gentle because there wasn't this, you know, I'm just going to stuff it all down and sit here and try and have a great meditation. It was more like, oh, okay, I need to be quite gentle here. But nonetheless, it was a bit dry at the beginning. So then I thought, where's my lion? Sort of gazed about and thought, where's my lion? And my lion was a bit over here, kind of looking a little bit lonely, curled up and looking a bit neglected. So I said, come on, come over here. You know? So my lion came over, and it was interesting out there when we did lion and everyone was growling. My lion is completely not like that. He's very, very beautiful, gentle lion. So he came over and he climbed into my lap, climbed right inside my lap, and he was kind of cycling down. And then I recalled a bit of Dharma. I thought, I'll do that. I'll recall a bit of Dharma to see what effect that has. And there's a particular practice where you imagine the kind of essence of the Buddha, I suppose, coming down through your head into your heart. And the language of this particular text I really adore, which is that your heart opens like a clam to become a pavilion of light. So that always works for me. Your heart opens like a clam to become a pavilion of light. So that I was trying to keep open to the tiredness and the pain whilst also allowing this pavilion. And then the lion was in the pavilion having a good old sniff. He was going to all the different corners of the pavilion, sort of sniffing around. You know, what's this corner like? So that was quite interesting. And then my lion seemed to want to climb down my spine, which was very interesting because normally lions might climb up, but he was going down. And again, this was interesting because I brought in a bit of will, I suppose. I want my lion to curl up right inside where my injuries are, which feels very raw at the moment. So to curl up in there and to soothe that area. And actually, it was too much. It was too intense. I thought, oh, no, I don't like that. So then it was like he moved out of there to... imagine that my belly is enormous. So he moved out and there was a kind of patch of grass and sunlight, and he curled up in the sunlight right in the middle of my belly. And then I felt ready to really sort of begin my meditation. So that was all just preparation, really. So I'd sort of come into my body and there was the lion. He was sort of settled down and I'd made a definite choice not to stay with that intensity. So that felt quite intelligent and skillful. And then I began to do my sadhana practice. So I do an Amitabha visualization practice. And then I was just really watching my mind in terms of the citta of craving, aversion and delusion. You know, how was that showing up, if at all? So at a certain point, there became mental events around, shall I buy a new iPad? Papadash is a bit interested in buying my one, you see. So that is that's so interesting. Oh, I'll give you my iPad for a good price. And then I get this opportunity for all this craving. So fascinating. Shall I buy a new iPad? I noticed that. And it's like, okay, not now, Vijayamala. Yeah. And that's such a great little phrase, not now, Vijayamala. Now is not the time to think about that. You know, think about it later when, you know, you've got a good internet, you're at home, you can research the prices properly and, you know, do it all properly. Don't just waste time in your meditation. So it was like this drawing back and coming back into my body. There was the line, there was the breath. Then at a certain point, there's Amitabha out there. So he's there. I'm doing my practice at the same time as just noticing when I'm moving away from my intention into craving or aversion. Then I noticed I was getting a bit caught up in what was I going to say in this talk. And that had a craving, sort of anxious quality. Trying to control, I suppose. You know, if I work it all out, there's an element of control there. And then I thought, okay, no, not now, Vijayamala. Drop back. But every time I noticed, this is craving, this is aversion, this is what the mind is doing. I had that choice then to just drop back to it. It feels quite physical of dropping back to the midline, which is why I think all the work we're doing, Padmanabhasana, around breathing in the centre of the body, I think is very good, because we're learning how to find that point of the midline balance when we're tipping into one or the other. Yeah. So it actually felt a very effective meditation. So I didn't come out of that thinking, oh God, you're really distracted. I came out of it thinking, God, that was really interesting. You know, I was really working with citta, and Amitabha was quite vivid. And I was using the image of the rupa here, but then I had an interesting thing around that looked a bit wooden. So the literal mind came in. Mm. So then it came, well, how can I bring the spirit of Amitabha that looks like that without it being this, you know, wooden figure? So that was all very interesting. So I'm just going to finish with a couple of thoughts on love and what of love. Because obviously that is citta. Citta is very associated with love. So we can become aware of our own mind, but how do we bring love into that? I think I did, you know, when I did a little bit when I got onto my siblings, or some of my siblings, and moved from aversion to an intention to try to cultivate forgiveness. That definitely felt quite loving. Or potentially loving. But we've been talking a lot about Indra's net, interconnectedness, flow. And if you take that to its logical conclusion, this idea that there's just me sitting here as an isolated, separate individual begins to fall apart. It doesn't have any enduring essence. So we are working on sort of clarifying our own mental events and our own minds, because that's a very important part of practice. But as we do that and we keep on dropping out of these very bound, contracted states of craving and aversion, and we're learning this new habit of just noticing it as it arises, and then dropping back into breath and body, we're dropping back into flow, and then things start to open up much more, and we get these glimmerings of an open, spacious consciousness, open, spacious awareness. So we can do it that way. But in bodhicitta, in Mahayana Buddhism, they do it quite differently, which I find very effective. When I was on my solitary, I did loads of bodhicitta practice. And there what you do is you just flip the whole thing on its head. And rather than defaulting to being obsessed by the delusion of self, you cultivate the opposite by just thinking of others all the time. So the other day, I think yesterday, I talked about Bhante's reading on we're all coagulations of the common stream of life. So that's what I am. I'm just this kind of condensation of physical, mental, and emotional process based on my own conditioning. And then I completely over-identify with that and call it me and get very addicted to all the content of me. But it's all deeply delusional and leads to incredible amount of suffering. So why don't I just think of others as an antidote to that? Because thinking of me all the time is delusional. So why don't I just think of others as a way of overcoming that default setting and continual over-identification with self or self-importance? That's one of the Tibetan teachers describes this as self-importance, which I think is really good. So rather than overcoming ego, because that can just sound a bit broad, we're overcoming this habituated tendency of self-importance, that I am the most important person in the universe. Of course, it's quite tricky teaching. We need to be very careful not to push away from self with aversion to think of others, because if it's like, well, I don't really like me, so I'm just going to think of you, that really won't work. Mm-hmm. But it's more, here I am, I'm whole, I'm present, I'm breathing, I'm in my body, I'm noticing my mind, I'm noticing my Vedana, dropping back to the midline. And now what I'm going to do is, rather than feeding this self as reference point, I'm going to quite actively just continually think of others. And you can do that by whatever I'm experiencing, others are experiencing. So in any given moment, whatever one is experiencing, you can be certain there are millions of people in the world who have having something almost identical. find it very powerful when my back pain's bad. Because if my back pain's bad, I can work on it. I can work on it in terms of softening my reaction, coming to my body, being kind, being gentle, all that kind of stuff, which is effective. But I can also just think of all the other millions of people in the world having back pain in this moment. And they long for freedom from distress just as much as I do. And I find that very heart-opening and in some ways more effective. So you have to stay with your own experience. So it's not a kind of denial. You stay with your own experience and then you open. Your own experience and you open. So I'm just going to finish with a few little quotes on that, which I find very, very moving. So Shanti Deva, who's the master at all this, exchanging self and other. I should eliminate the suffering of others because it is suffering, just like my own suffering. I should take care of others because they are sentient beings, just as I am a sentient being. So beautiful. Although it has many divisions, such as its arms and legs and so on, the body is protected as a whole. Likewise, different beings, with their sorrows and joys, are equal, like myself, in their yearning for happiness. Again, I find that very moving. So Nagasiddhi's been talking about the body being an ecosystem, incredibly complicated. But I identify with that as a whole. But I've got arms and legs and digestion and bones and all kinds of things. And I think this is a whole. I can have that relationship with all human beings. So just like I've got arms, I can think we're all limbs of life. So we are all in this room as limbs of one consciousness, one life. And we can train ourselves in that kind of way. We can train ourselves to identify with life as all being limbs of a kind of big, much bigger consciousness. And Patril Rinpoche, who's one of my absolute heroes, he was a completely wacky 19th century Tibetan yogi. Absolutely brilliant. If you want to read a wonderful book, it's called Enlightened Vagabond. And it's about him just roaming around the Tibetan mountains, living in yak hair tents, teaching the Dharma, practicing the Dharma continually, very fierce, profoundly loving. Really all he taught was compassion, but he did it in a very uncompromising way. He says, completely eradicate all those wrong attitudes based on attachment and aversion, which makes you reject others and care only for yourself, and think of yourself and others as being entirely equal. Completely eradicate all those wrong attitudes based on attachment and aversion, which makes you reject others and care only for yourself, and think of yourself and others as being entirely equal. So we're all equally arising and passing as process of life. Yeah. So we're kind of unique and we're equal at the same time. It's all very mysterious. And then another guy, Padampa Rinpoche, I think he's called, which is absolute pith. Whatever you experience, think of others. That might be the only thing you take away from this course, this talk. Whatever you experience, think of others. And like I said, I've been doing this as my main practice for quite a while now, and I find it incredibly transformative. Incredibly transformative. You can't go wrong, basically. And it's what Nagasiddhi was saying last night about green Tara, and an act of simple act of kindness can be absolutely immense. And Dado Rinpoche, who's one of Bhante's teachers, I really love this as well. Somebody asked him, one of the members of the order went to visit him in Kalimpong?
Kalimpong.
Yeah. And said, how do you know if you're making spiritual progress? And he said, you get a little bit kinder every day. Isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. You get a little bit kinder every day. He didn't say you have great cosmic experiences. You get a little bit kinder.